The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Senator Mitch McConnell discusses his 2016 decision to kill the vote on then-judge and now Attorney General Merrick Garland.
But I do think the issue that you raise is the single most consequential thing I've done in my time as Majority Leader of the Senate.
Democrats worry he could do it again.
If they lose the Senate in 2022, even if it's 51-49, they're deeply worried what's going to happen.
President Biden's bilateral meeting with Vladimir Putin.
This guy is really good at this. He's a KGB agent. He knows how to read people. He knows how to study people.
And later, why are people still wearing masks outdoors?
It's a screw you to all the people who didn't want to wear masks during the pandemic.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. At 79 years old, GOP Senate leader Mitch McConnell remains in firm control of the Republican caucus in the Senate. He's as sharp, patient, and transparent as ever, still working on an agenda of freedom and growth across America. Earlier this week, we spoke and our conversation made national news. We discussed his 2016 decision to keep Antonin Scalia's seat open after the late, great Justice died unexpectedly in February of that year. Even before President Barack Obama nominated now Attorney General Merrick Garland to fill that vacancy, Senator McConnell had declared that there would be no hearings and no votes regardless of who was nominated. Much of the media and nearly all of the Democrats portrayed that decision as a betrayal of the system, and that was wrong. We talked about that decision and clarified whether or not he'd do it again. But Senator McConnell does not back down under pressure, and he signaled yes. In fact, if he's back in charge, the same McConnell rule will apply. Here's our conversation from The Hugh Hewitt Show. It's been 5 years since the terrible day, February 13th, that Justice Scalia died. But on the same day, you took the most significant decision in con law since Brown v. Board, which is a good decision, and Roe v. Wade, which was an awful decision, when you said the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court. Therefore, this vacancy should not be filled until we have a new president. Had you not done so, it's my view that President Trump would not have been elected, and we wouldn't have Justices Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Now, you occasionally get heat from the right among the more populist people and some of the folks in my business. Does it just chaff you that they do not bring up that the court and the Constitution would be in quicksand up to its neck if you had not taken the position you did 5 years ago and we did not have the court that we do today where we're looking forward and not in fear at a series of decisions this year and next?
Well, look, you can't be the Republican leader of the Senate and not take a few slings and arrows, but I do think the issue that you raise is the single most consequential thing I've done in my time as Majority Leader of the Senate. Preserve the Scalia vacancy or the Gorsuch appointment. The Brett Kavanaugh appointment was certainly challenging and controversial. And, of course, we had very little time left when Justice Ginsburg passed away, and that took a good deal of priority and, I think, skill to get Amy Coney Barrett through. And I think we'll find out what a difference it makes for the American people to have Supreme Court justices, and for that matter, 54 new circuit judges who believe in the quaint notion that maybe the job of a judge is to actually follow the law.
The Sixth Circuit, Judge Thapar, one of your friends, and I think believe you sponsored his nominee, they came down with a great decision on the unconstitutionality of race-based punishments or benefits. And that's a Sixth Circuit decision. I don't know if the court will take that up, but you're right. We're getting great decisions from the circuit. We're also now about to get nominees from Joe Biden. And that's fine. That's what presidents do. They nominate. Do you expect Senator Manchin to be with the Republicans on the nominees who might be more radical than is outside the norm? I mean, we had some pretty conservative originalists. I don't mind them having some pretty liberal living constitution enthusiasts, but there are some radicals out there that I just don't think have the temperament for the bench. Do you think Senator Manchin would join, or Senator Sinema for that matter?
I don't know. You know, Manchin voted against Barrett, and also Sinema voted against Barrett. And they are Democrats. I do respect them both for their important decision to save the Senate by not eliminating the filibuster. That's an extraordinarily important institutional part of the Senate. I admire that greatly. How they're going to vote on judges, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
I'll come back to that in a second, but while we're on the filibuster, is it just Senators Manchin and Sinema that for some reason the press can find them? They can never find Maggie Hassan. They can never find Raphael Warnock. They can never find Mark Kelly or Cortez Masto, the four Democrats who are in danger. They can't find them to ask them about the filibuster or D.C. statehood or any of the other wacky ideas like expanding and packing the Supreme Court. Have you talked to them? Are they actually in favor of the filibuster, or are they just hiding?
Well, I think most of them have chosen not to say. And my guess is Schumer, with a 50-50 Senate, will not try this unless he's got all of his ducks in a row. So we may never find out what those other senators actually feel about this important rule, which is the essence of the Senate. I mean, that is the essence of the Senate, the legislative filibuster. It requires us to have a 60-vote majority to do things. That's been the way the Senate's been for quite a long time. We never, you know, President Trump wanted me to get rid of it, and I said politely, no, we're not going to do that. The institution of the Senate is too important for either side to take a short-term advantage by blowing it up.
Let me ask you, if you regain the majority in 2022, would the rule that you applied in 2016 to the Scalia vacancy apply in 2024 to any vacancy that occurred then?
Well, I think in the middle of a presidential election, if you have a Senate of the opposite party of the president, you have to go back to the 1880s to find the last time a vacancy was filled. So I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, no, I don't think either party, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election.
Go to my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, for the entire interview with Senator McConnell. The reaction of the left to that conversation was swift and sometimes over the top. I discussed the concerns of Democrats and media with Byron York of the Washington Examiner. Why a heart attack on the left over the obvious statement that if the party is the same as the president nominee, sail through in election years, and if it's opposite, they don't?
Well, I think in the news business, occasionally, we do have frenzies when somebody states the obvious. And, you know, you say to yourself, would Mitch McConnell really change his position, you know, after what he did with Merrick Garland in the Scalia opening? Well, no. But you have a lot of Democratic anxiety. And remember, these people who were talking about this on the news are Democrats. You have a lot of anxiety. You have a 50-50 Senate. That's very difficult. And you have this pattern of increasingly partisan Supreme Court votes. I mean, if you look just at, I looked this up while you were talking, if you look just at the three Trump nominations, Gorsuch is confirmed 54-45 with three Democratic votes. That's Manchin, Heitkamp, and Donnelly. And Kavanaugh is confirmed 50-48 with one Democratic vote. And then Barrett is confirmed 52-48 with zero Democratic votes. So, now they have 50 votes in the Senate. So, you know, getting a Breyer replacement or anybody else through the Senate right now is going to be difficult. So if they lose the Senate in 2022, even if it's 51-49, they're deeply worried what's going to happen.
And then the overstatement follows. Joy Reid, she's a friend of mine. I've been working with her for years, saying that Mitch McConnell is wickedness in high places and is evil. And, you know, let's just overstate things just a touch. But what they don't deal with is that Harry Reid is the guy who changed the filibuster rule for judges, generally, tried to leave the Supreme Court exception. Mitch said, no, 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 sauce for the goose, on for the gander. We're not going to play by your rules and have you break it later when it's your nominee, which is what the Reid rule allows them to do. But the thing that the key point of the interview, Byron, is that the Supreme Court is dealing this year. We're waiting to hear about the Catholic Church in Philadelphia. We are waiting. They did not take the Harvard case yesterday. They waited. They asked for the opinion of the Department of Justice under Joe Biden, which was a great tactical move, because now the Biden administration must explicitly state whether they're for or against discrimination on Asian American applicants. And then the justices can decide to take the case. And then next year it's abortion and guns. Why would Stephen Breyer quit when his nomination is just as assured in 2023, June, July of 2023, in that summer, and get himself off before the crucial year in his judicial career?
Well, I think that, first of all, there's zero reason for him to quit right now.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think the Democratic anxiety, and thus the MSNBC anxiety, will increase next year, depending on what the Senate map looks like. But I think, I think the lesson of Amy Coney Barrett for Democrats would be, look, if you've got a nomination, if you've got a vacancy and a Democratic president and the election is in 10 minutes, get this thing done in 8 minutes. So I think this pressure on Breyer is actually going to increase because with a Republican Senate, they can just kind of forget it. Now, I thought it was interesting in your interview with McConnell about what happens in a 2023 situation, if there's a Republican Senate and President Biden, what happens there? 2024, there's just no doubt. If there's a Republican Senate and a President Biden, there's not going to be a confirmation. There's not even going to be a consideration.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter who the nominee is. It's just like, it's not about Merrick Garland. It was no hearings, no votes before Garland was nominated. He just said it out of the box.
Correct. And he does have historical precedent on his side about this. So the question, though, is 2023. And I think McConnell left the door open. I mean, if the Senate will not even consider a nominee of the opposite party in the year before election, because McConnell used the phrase, if we're in the middle of an election. So, what does that mean? I think if the party would not consider a Biden nominee in 2023, then I think we've got some sort of breakdown in the system of confirming Supreme Court justices.
Coming up, President Biden meets with Vladimir Putin.
This guy is really good at this. He's a KGB agent. He knows how to read people. He knows how to study people.
KT McFarland, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. President Biden was in Europe this past week for his most high-profile set of meetings since taking office. The president met with members of the G7 in Cornwall in the UK, then with NATO members in Brussels and the EU summit also in Brussels. But the key meeting, the one that really mattered, was in Geneva on Wednesday. President Biden's bilateral summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. KT McFarland was President Trump's first deputy national security advisor. She joined my colleague Chris DeGaulle on AM 990 The Answer in Philadelphia.
Vladimir Putin took an open shot calling out the evils of the Democrat government for locking up and torturing political dissidents under the guise of a fake insurrection. That's jaw-dropping that Putin is now accusing our government of holding people captive over political differences, which one could certainly argue that's happening right now, KT.
Yeah, and it's not just Putin, it's the Chinese as well. When the first meeting between Biden administration officials and the Chinese government in Alaska a couple of months ago, what was their response? You know, America, you have no right to lecture us on human rights or on Hong Kong and on the Uyghurs, because look at you. You know, look at your racism. Look at your critical race theory. But the thing that the communists, that Putin and Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, and their leaders, they continue to come after us, not by accusing us of crimes that they think we've committed, but they use our own words against us. And this is their very invidious sort of clever way of doing it, because it immediately puts you on the defensive. So what did the Biden administration people do when they were called out by the Chinese in Alaska? They apologize. And that's why they're doing it. And they use our own words against us. And I think that, you know, it's often lost on most people, but the world right now is at a tipping point. And the American century, the American leadership in the world, liberal democratic order, the democracies, free market capitalism, we've always, in our lifetimes, have always thought, well, that's the key to success. Other countries have emulated us. But now there's the Chinese version of events. And they're trying to win a diplomatic war, a communications battle. And they're telling the world, look, America, democracy, you're not equipped to deal with the 21st century. You couldn't deal with the pandemic. You couldn't deal with the economic crisis in 2008. Your day is over. Our day is coming. And maybe it's a lot of braggadocio, but other nations in the world are looking at that. And they're saying, well, gee, maybe I better, you know, I don't like China. I don't like what they're doing. I don't like the demands that they're making on us. I don't like their unfair trade practices. But maybe I better cut my deal with them while I can, because America's a fading power. It was when Joe Biden said about 2 weeks ago, he said, well, you know, I've met with Xi Jinping a lot. I've met with everybody a lot because I've been around forever. He said that the Chinese president, he is convinced in his bones that he's going to own us in a decade. And my response was, great, I'm really glad, President Biden, that you finally recognized what the Chinese threat is. But my next point was, okay, so what's the plan? What's our response? We're not just going to roll over and let them run the world. And yet I don't see any plan coming out of the Biden administration, whether it's to deal with the Chinese president or now that he's walking in the meeting with the Russian president.
What is your read on just the body language? I said Putin sits there like my teenage son, you know, kind of, you know, slouched in his chair with his legs spread, and Biden sitting there with his legs folded and his hands crossed on his lap. I just the picture. What does it say?
Well, it says that Putin is the guy in charge of the meeting. You know, look, this guy is really good at this. He's a KGB agent. He knows how to read people. He knows how to study people. There was a picture of Putin years ago meeting with President Obama, and Obama was lecturing him on something, and Putin was sort of looking out the window, picking bits of fluff off his lapel. And I thought, that tells you everything.
Yes.
And that's the equivalent of what he's doing now. He's looking in command of the meeting, and I'm just concerned that the visual image that gives is not one that is going to be good for us, and particularly after all these meetings that Biden has just had. Biden had one job when he went to Europe, in my mind, and that was to convince our trading and security and economic partners to join with us to stand up to China and to stand up to Russia, and he's failed.
Documentary filmmaker Ami Horowitz is known for his on-the-street interview. Recently, he took on the trend of wearing masks outdoors, even in a largely vaccinated United States. He discussed his latest work with Salem host Dennis Prager.
I was asking vaccinated people why they're wearing masks outside. And in fact, we happen to be in a park, like in an open space park. And I would say in the neighborhood where I live, in the neighborhood that we shot it in, at the time, I would say it was about 30 to 40% of people wear masks outside. So obviously it's self-select because I'm only asking people who are wearing masks, right? So they're all gonna be in that same bucket. You know, it's something about me, and maybe I have to see a therapist about this. Well, I got to see a therapist about a lot of things, but in this thing in particular, I have found that I'm becoming angry with people who say, oh, we got to play it extra safe, or, you know, I don't feel comfortable. I don't know why I would be angry at somebody else, but I am. It angers me. And it's made me look at even close friends of mine who have taken that position and say, God, I mean, is that somebody I want to be friends with who's just so scared of life and scared of the world? And maybe it's just me, but that's kind of the emotion I felt around this issue.
So you're standing, he's standing there in Manhattan asking masked people outdoors why they're wearing masks. I mentioned one of them before you came on, a woman just acknowledging that it's a pacifier.
Yeah, acknowledging it about herself.
Not one response, if I recall, spoke of it in medical terms. It was all some other issue of I feel better, I don't want to stick out, it's my public duty. Am I right?
Yeah, so there was three buckets, right? So bucket one, and I'm not sure which of the three are most disturbing, frankly. One was peer pressure. Hey, you know, my friends are doing it, and I feel weird not wearing it around my friends, and they'll look at me differently and think I'm, you know, whatever. That was bucket one. Bucket two was screw you. Like, I'm wearing it. Like, I told each of these people that the science that, remember, the great thing about this was, follow the science, right? That was, they were screaming and yelling at the top of their lungs throughout this entire pandemic. And, of course, they don't follow the science. The science, first of all, has been clear for a long time, but now has even been made public by the CDC that you simply don't need to wear a mask outside. But they still are saying, you know what, it's a screw you to all the people who didn't want to wear masks during the pandemic, that I will wear this anyways, even though I don't have to wear it. One guy said he has a privilege as a person to be able to not wear a mask, and therefore he won't wear a mask in solidarity with the people who don't have the privilege of not wearing a mask. It was bizarre. It was weird and bizarre. And then the last bucket was people were just... I know what they say, but I just want to be extra careful. I just want to be extra an abundance of caution. And that's just, again, all of them infuriate me. That one probably infuriates me the most. And by the way, if we had to follow the abundance of caution mantra during the creation of the vaccine, believe you me, we would not have had a vaccine for another 3 or 4 years, right? I mean, and the president showed that when he pulled the J&J vaccine for basically no reason, literally 1 in a million chance of something happening. He pulled a vaccine in the time we were trying to get vaccines out. So believe me, if he was in charge of Operation Warp Speed, it would be Operation Slow Speed, and it would take years out of an abundance of caution to have a vaccine come out.
Coming up,
Rashida Tlaib says freedom of speech does not exist for Muslim women in Congress. Did you pull out the Muslim and the female card?
Larry Elder, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Hi, everyone. Hugh Hewitt for Bambi. That's right, Bambi. Have you heard of it before? B-A-M-B-E-E. It was created specifically for small businesses because we know that small businesses can often get sunk by HR problems. HR issues can kill your business. Well, Bambi is here to save you that problem. It is specifically designed for small business. You get a dedicated HR manager, craft your HR policy, and maintain your compliance all for just $99 a month. Now, I've run a couple of law firms, I run a foundation, and I run a business. And I know that HR is a headache. It doesn't have to be. Bambi can change it from a headache to a profit center overnight. From onboarding to termination, Bambi will customize your policies to fit your business. Go to Bambi.com/townhall right now to schedule your free HR audit. That's Bambi.com/townhall. Bambee.com/townhall. Bambee.com/townhall. You'll be glad you did. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Members of the Squad, a group of congresswomen who have been regularly accused of anti-Semitism, are fighting battles on two fronts, against conservatives who do not like their rhetoric and against mainstream Democratic leaders who find their words damaging to the brand. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar set off the latest round by comparing Israel and the United States to the terrorists of Hamas. Here's Larry Elder.
Ilhan Omar has accused Jewish Democrats now of, quote, offensive Islamophobia and harassment. Accused Democrats of this. Because a statement signed by 12 Jewish Democrat members of the House questioned Omar about her comments. Again, here is what Ilhan Omar said.
I haven't seen any evidence in either cases that domestic courts can both can and will prosecute alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity. And I would emphasize that in Israel and Palestine, this includes crimes committed by both the Israeli security forces and Hamas. In Afghanistan, it includes crimes committed by the Afghan national government and the Taliban.
Congressman Ben Schneider, Democrat, Illinois, questioned Omar for appearing to legitimize terrorism by putting her own country in Israel in with the Taliban. Omar fired back in a tweet, quote, "It's shameful for colleagues who call me when they need my support to now put out a statement asking for a clarification and not just call. The Islamophobic tropes in this statement are offensive," she tweets. "The constant harassment and silencing from the signers of this letter is unbearable." She said, "My statements were not a moral comparison between Hamas and Taliban and the U.S. and Israel, although it sounded like that. I was in no way equating terrorist organizations with democratic countries with well-established judicial systems," close quote, although it sounded like that. And the squad is closing ranks after Omar accused her Jewish Democrat colleagues of offensive Islamophobia and harassment. Rashida Tlaib says freedom of speech does not exist for Muslim women in Congress. So she pulled out the Muslim and the female card. House Democrat leadership should be ashamed of its relentless, exclusive tone policing congresswomen of color. Ilhan Omar accused her critics within the Democratic Party of whipping up, quote, Islamic hate against her, close quote. And a progressive Democrat caucus chairwoman, the chair member named Pramila Jayapal, called Omar a, quote, deeply valued member of the caucus and said, and I'm quoting, "We cannot ignore a right-wing media echo chamber that has deliberately and routinely attacked a black Muslim woman in Congress, distorting her views and intentions and resulting in threats against Representative Omar and her staff," end of quote. Now, AOC is blaming all of this on right-wing media.
I believe that her comments were absolutely mischaracterized. She was very clearly speaking about the ICC investigations, which name these four actors in two suits. And they name them in context of events that happened in Afghanistan with the United States and the Taliban, and in Palestine with Hamas. And to say that, and I believe that to assert that she was equating these two entities when she was speaking about the ICC investigations, in which all four parties are being investigated for instances of war crimes, I believe to assert that this was equating these two, I believe was not it was not a generous interpretation whatsoever.
Not a generous interpretation whatsoever. What does that even mean?
You know, these very intense news cycles, which, by the way, started, this whole hubbub started with right wing news outlets taking what she said out of context.
There it is. Now, Nancy Pelosi has thanked Ilhan Omar for clarifying her statement and says, we're going to move on.
No, I'm not responding that the Congresswoman Omar is a valued member of our caucus. She asked her questions of the Secretary of State. Nobody criticized those about how people will be held accountable if we're not going to the International Court of Justice. That was a very legitimate question. Mm-hmm. That was not of concern. Members did.
A large and growing number of Democrats believe that Israel is the bad guy. They do not have the ability to separate the arsonist from the firefighter and believe that Israel just parachuted in there after World War II and displaced all these poor Palestinians. That is their view of this dispute. Even Bill Maher slammed it. This is 70% of Jews pull the lever for the Democratic Party. Half of Jews say that Israel is important to them. To a growing number of Democrats, it is not.
Coming up, Pastor Vodi Bakum.
That's what you get with critical race theory. You get racism without a racist.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. A handful of states have banned the teaching of critical race theory in one form or another. A dozen more are debating the same. In his book, Fault Lines, The Social Justice Movement and Evangelism's Looming Catastrophe, Pastor Vody Bachman details the problems with critical race theory. He recently joined Salem Host Kevin McCullough on AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
I know that it had to be somewhat surreal for you to see the last 16 months from afar, but as you watched the United States grapple with COVID and then the George Floyd incident and the riots following, and really what was at that point in time kind of the tow bar that got jammed in the door, and now everything is being literally associated with social justice and critical race theory. They certainly didn't prop up at that time, but that was certainly a megaphone. What have been some of your thoughts as you've watched all of those events, the events of the election, the transition of administrations, and where we are even now? What are some of the thoughts that went through your mind as a believer and as an American living overseas?
Yeah, that last statement is the most important one. You know, being an American expat, living overseas, seeing how these things are portrayed, that's really what motivated me to speak out more passionately about these issues. I mean, we live in a country where there's real police corruption and real police brutality. We live in a country where police will set up a roadblock and stop you on the street and find a violation, and you have to pull over and pay your fine in cash on the side of the road, and where people are, you know, routinely beaten, you know, when they're caught for crimes. So when our students there in Zambia begin to ask about whether or not I was afraid of the police in America, alarm bells went off as I thought about the way things were being portrayed. Because the fact of the matter is, the police force in most of our cities here in the United States are incredibly professional. The overwhelming majority of the men and women who serve in that regard are professionals who put their life on the line every day. And although there are people, you know, just like in every profession, that don't do it the right way, for the most part, that doesn't characterize policing in America. You know, one of the interesting things about the Derek Chauvin case, they threw the book at him. They threw the whole kitchen sink at him. And, you know, there were law experts who were arguing that, you know, what he did didn't even meet, you know, some of the criteria for some of the things he was charged with.
And just for my listeners, I want them to know that Derek Chauvin is the officer in the George Floyd case. And he was the one that, want to make that clear.
And I'm no expert, so I can't speak to that. But what I can speak to is this. What was amazing to me about that case was what he wasn't charged with. Because supposedly, this was a referendum on racist policing. But he wasn't charged with a hate crime because it couldn't be proven. Because there was no evidence that what happened to that man happened because he was black. And the argument is being made from a systemic perspective as opposed to the merits of the individual case. And that's what you get with critical race theory. You get racism without a racist. You get racism simply because we see disparate numbers in terms of black people killed by police versus white people killed by police, you know, based on their percentage of the population. And so that's a classic example of what we're talking about here with critical race theory.
Right.
Critical race theory sees racism without racist. You don't need a person to be racist in order for an action to be racist. You just need, you know, a disparate representation of a particular group of people, and that's all it takes.
What are we talking about when we're talking about critical theory in the modern church life today?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. Number one, this is absolutely coming into the church, and it's coming into the church because Christians are all about justice. And so social justice sounds appealing to us. Racial justice sounds appealing to us. The second reason that is creeping in is because Christians in America have been inundated with neo-Marxism. The overwhelming majority of Christians have gone to government schools and send their children to government schools. K through 12, you spend 14,000 instructional hours in school. And our schools are rooted and grounded in things like critical pedagogy, which is cultural Marxism, neo-Marxism applied to the educational system. So when you have people who have this sort of predisposition based on their training and education, and when you have people who also want to be about justice, it's easy to see why something that sounds good, that, you know, sort of tickles the ears in terms of this ideology that we've been inundated with, can manifest itself in the church. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that this neo-Marxist ideology is completely incompatible with biblical truth. The idea of social justice, for example, is the idea of redistributive justice. It's the idea that justice is about equity, about equal outcomes, not about the equal application of the law, so on and so forth. And so when you start thinking about, you know, this sort of redistributive justice, and that it's the government who has to be the one to redistribute resources and opportunities and so on and so forth, you get away from the biblical idea of racism, which is about prejudice from one person to another based on a person's race or ethnicity. And you also move away from the gospel being the answer to the government being the answer. So all of that is hugely problematic in terms of the church adopting these ideas.
Does it threaten the message or the core of the gospel directly?
Yeah, it absolutely does. Because now you got people, for example, Ibrahim Kendi. Ibrahim Kendi was being interviewed. He's the author of the book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. And when he was interviewed about this, he talked about the difference between this liberation theology and this savior theology. Liberation theology being the idea that, you know, Jesus came to liberate oppressed peoples, as opposed to this arcane idea that he came to deliver individual sinners from their sin. It was an open attack on the gospel. But yeah, again, his voice is one of the loudest in this whole critical social justice movement. And he's clearly, one of the things I appreciate him about Kendi is how clear he is about what the critical social justice movement is and how clear he is about how at odds this movement is with the truth of Scripture and with the message of the gospel.
There's a lot more to that conversation between McCullough and Bodie Bachman. Go to Town Hall Review for the entire discussion. Coming up.
This is a United States congresswoman comparing the United States and Israel to terrorists.
Mike Gallagher with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day.
This week, the former CDC director criticizes his colleagues for dismissing the lab leak theory on coronavirus.
I would never expect that from the scientific community.
They'll take a closer look.
We were not permitted to float ideas of what happened with COVID, how it started, how it got out. None of this was permissible to be discussed on our major social media platforms.
Vogue magazine publishes an article arguing that it's morally wrong to have a baby.
Having a baby is immoral, an act of pure environmental vandalism in 2021.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised. Birth rates are down.
We're creating societies of a kind that have just never existed in human history.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Earlier, we looked at the growing battle between the Squad and traditional Democratic leadership. In our final segment, my colleague at Salem, Mike Gallagher, reacts to the effort to sweep some of the most troubling statements under the rug.
On Monday, Ilhan Omar tweeted, We have seen unthinkable atrocities committed by the U.S., Hamas, Israel, Afghanistan, and the Taliban. I asked Secretary of State Antony Blinken where people are supposed to go for justice. This is a United States congresswoman comparing the United States and Israel to terrorists. In a normal world, that would be a pretty big deal. Oh, no, no, no. But the Democrats, they're using the old out-of-context comments were mischaracterized. I'm reading the tweet. Here's AOC, cut six on CNN.
I believe that her comments were absolutely mischaracterized. She was very clearly speaking about the ICC investigations, which name these four actors in two suits. And they name them in context of events that happened in Afghanistan with the United States and the Taliban, and in Palestine with Hamas and the government of Israel. I believe that to assert that she was equating these two entities when she was speaking about the ICC investigations, in which all four parties are being investigated for instances of war crimes, to assert this was equating these two, I believe was not a generous interpretation whatsoever. You know, these very intense news cycles, which, by the way, started, this whole hubbub started with right-wing news outlets taking what she said out of context.
AOC tried to convince a TV audience that that's out of context. That's a hubbub created by right-wing media. Maybe Nancy Pelosi. She's going to have a more reasoned, diplomatic approach, and she will denounce and rebuke the anti-Semitic, anti-American tweet by Ilhan Omar, right?
Congresswoman Omar is a valued member of our caucus. She asked her questions of the Secretary of State. Nobody criticized those about how people will be held accountable if we're not going to the International Court of Justice. That was a very legitimate question. Mm-hmm. That was not of concern. Members did become concerned when the tweet that was put out equated the United States with the Taliban. Then she clarified it, mm-hmm. and we thanked her for clarification.
So do you want people to just let it go?
Then they can say whatever they want. But what I'm saying is end of subject.
End of subject. Turn the page. Don't believe your lying eyes, and don't you dare be offended that a sitting member of Congress accused the United States of terrorism.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producers Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Bouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.